All right, here we are. Welcome back to Bookwave, the book club podcast. We're here with Pat,
Hey.
Will,
Hello.
And Synapsian.
Hey there.
And today we're looking at the Book of Joshua, going through the Holy Bible book club series. And the first question, or if you're new around here, you should check us out at our website, bookwave.club, and like and subscribe, comment if you have any questions or comments for us. Yeah, today we're looking at the Book of Joshua, and my first question to you about this book was, what did you notice about the shifting dynamic between the Israelites under Moses and the Israelites under Joshua?
I want to jump in right away and not address your first question, because I do want to say that if you do check out our website in the coming couple weeks, we're going to start updating that with bios about us. You can get to know the team and our interests, our dislikes, that sort of stuff. Anything that you do want to see on the website, if you want to comment, message us in Discord, you know where to find us. But to address your question, I think the biggest difference I saw when the Israelites went to Joshua was a significant lack of sort of confusion and just overall more consistency. Like, they had gotten to this place where they stopped complaining and doubting, and it was time. They're in the promised land and they had an agenda and they were doing stuff until they got to Shiloh, just like they said in Genesis. And I think it was very obvious that all the Israelites were sort of gung-ho about this. They had gotten out of the wilderness. Joshua was allowed to cross the River Jordan with them, and they were burning and pillaging and villaging, and it was just nice to see, you know, uniformity.
Yeah. There was one line that I dug into a little bit more than others, and it was just like when the people were talking to Joshua, and it was just like a passing line that said, "We will obey you just like we did Moses before you." And I'm like, that doesn't really make any sense considering how many times the Israelites disobeyed Moses. But then I like watched a couple of videos and read a little bit on it, and it's just like, no, this was the next generation. The guys that had disobeyed Moses and rebelled against him, they had already died out. And they'd kill the guys that, you know, did the crimes that they were all worried about. So these guys kind of know their laws better than the ones before them.
Essentially, yeah. And just moving up the ranks and knowing that Joshua, by direct contrast, was just leading the rest of the people through these different cities and conquering them and just believing in him. And it's essential for it's a kind of just leadership mentality where, you know, you essentially have to trust in the spiritual responsibility and in order to conquer and thrive.
Yeah, I think we saw like that sort of art of war, unification under one banner stuff that really makes an army maintain a high level of morale, executing orders, and overall just not questioning leadership, because there's that trust and sort of that sense of faith, like you're saying. I mean, there was, I think, the city of Ai or A or something like that, where they had one sort of issue. Someone had grab some cursed stuff, and they dealt with that pretty quickly. But overall, like, when you think about taking over a giant region, I'd say they did pretty good. What do you think, Synapsian?
Well, I think I found a lot of similarities between the tale of Moses and this one of Joshua. In Moses, this is kind of the first generation, like Scott alluded to, this being the second generation of people. You know, they come out of the wandering in the desert for 40 years, and this is like their children. But the other similarity I saw was, you know, this is the finalization of the covenant that God made with Abraham, where it is the promised land of Canaan. Jacob, I believe, had previously been in this land way back in the Genesis story. And it's really what I read into it was more of a divine land grant ceremony. So God's making this blood covenant with the people of Israel and essentially saying you got to adhere to all these Deuteronomistic rules, which we've laid out before. And under the Moses story in Deuteronomy, we saw that covenant recapitulated, and it's just being redone here again, I think, near the end of it. Well, actually, in the first part, few chapters, Joshua summarizes what the covenants are. And then at the end, I think he says, you guys are not worthy of you're not worthy of God because he's holy and you guys are going to, be foolish like you were before. So that's the main similarity I saw. The people acting foolish, they're essentially living in a land where there were lots of idols. And this Yahweh of theirs is saying that you cannot have any other idols. I am the one, the only. And so that's really the challenging part for them in this time of the Bronze Age, where they want to maybe worship other idols, other gods, but their God is saying, if you want this promise, which I've made with you, this covenant, you have to believe in me only.
And
I would imagine that'd be pretty difficult.
I think we see that sort of fear of like internally in the society that they're afraid that they're gonna falter. And I think, yeah, chapter 22 on the West Bank, the 2.5 tribes build this altar and they call it Ed. And everybody on the other side freaks out and they're like, oh great, they've done it again. They're starting to worship idols and they all go across and they're like, we're gonna kill you now. And they're like, wait, 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 wait. It's just like a witness. We love God. We're not gonna do the things that you're saying we're gonna do. Settle down. And they're like, oh, all right, cool. Because like you had us worried there.
No, this isn't for another God. This is for our friendship, you know?
And it doesn't really make sense.
Like, oh, it's
Like,
just a big misunderstanding. Let's shake hands and, agree to live on these two sides of the river. Let's be friendly with each other.
I think it's kind of a test of willpower because they are trying so desperately to follow Joshua and the word of God that over time, when the Israelites are exposed to many different aspects throughout their journey, typically, they will find a time where they will, again, falter and their own sanity levels tend to decrease.
And it's odd too, because this has nothing to do with what you're saying, but I don't know, they recapitulated those like sanctuary cities, and I really want to do more research on that because it's so important that when they're dividing the land, again, they say, okay, we need a city where if you accidentally kill somebody, you can run to and seek refuge until you're tried in a court before the person that's upset with you kills you. And that's like the way they lay it down, like it's something they've clearly been doing for a long time, and it's something that has to stay. And I don't really see any sort of etymology to that ceremony of having sanctuary cities. So that's something that hopefully maybe older texts will answer. Is there anything you know about that, Scott?
Well, you could make the same comparison to like the abolition of slavery. Like it was just a commonplace thing until, we got rid of it. But until like we got to a point where we were enforcing things with prisons and with executions, that they just exiled them. Get your excommunicated from the tribe, so get out of here if you can make your way in another tribe, then, you know, maybe your sins will be forgiven by them, but not by us, kind of thing. I think that's the concept that's really going on there.
Right.
But another contrast between Joshua and Moses was you could kind of like see Moses as more of like a politician and like the lawgiver, and Joshua was much more of just the general. Even during the time of Moses, Joshua was considered like his military hand kind of person.
Yeah, and especially with Joshua's sons too. They're like captains in a way.
And yeah, and you see like quite literally he's you know, planning ambushes and raising cities and leaving testimonies to the fact that these kings have been destroyed. And as a nation, they've struck fear into the hearts of this entire country, which I think is really interesting at a time when there isn't texting. Like, the only form of communication to get across distances that I know of at that time period is like carrier pigeons. And they roll up into Jericho, and this harlot Rahab is like, hey, like, we're all really scared of you, so let's make a pact, you guys. How about you hide in my roof, and then when you come back, don't kill me or my dad or my brothers or my sisters or my children. And it's just like, whoa, so everybody knows about their God, and everybody knows what they did in Egypt. Yeah. And it's like, so,
and there's a reference to Passover be. There's a reference to Passover there too, with the she hangs a scarlet rope out of her window to say, like, oh, this represents the blood, the same as in Passover. We'll pass over this house if we see the red ribbon. And then, you know, one of the biggest little tidbits of information that kept popping up every time I tried to research this was Rahab was actually the distant ancestor of Jesus Christ himself. So that's clearly the most important part of the book.
Like, come on. Can we just talk about the Old Testament without the lens of it being this prophecy of Jesus Christ? Can we not just look at it as the Old Testament?
Absolutely. That's what I'm saying. I just had to say that.
Not you, personally. I mean, we as a human race.
One thing I found interesting with this story is after reading about it, this was written possibly 1,000 years after this supposed events took place in Jericho. And Jericho itself was allegedly one of the oldest cities on earth. And here we have, at the very beginning of the chapter, one of God's like right-hand commanders meets Joshua right before they cross the Jordan. And I just thought it was kind of interesting that God has like this army of people. It's almost like they didn't know what to do with some of the lesser gods from Mesopotamia and Greek culture. So they just turned those lesser gods into these like the Lord's army, essentially. And it reminded me a lot about the Crusades. They're essentially going into Jericho and Ai, and I think they killed, you know, 12,000 something people. And, you know, these people's hearts are melted with fear because they know, you know, that these Israelites are like Black Lives Matter people. They're bad motherfuckers.
Jeez.
And I just thought that was interesting that the Lord has this army. And they talk about the Lord's treasury later on in the chapter after they sack Jericho and Ai. Achan, I think, steals from the Lord's treasury. And what's significant about that is they actually use those treasures, those plunders from the sacked cities to circulate within their community. So they're calling it the Lord's treasure, but the priestly class are the ones who have access to that, and they can use that to trade with other neighbors, trade for slaves or whatever.
Yeah, that
whatever it is
that
need.
Pops up a lot where they're like, especially in the first city, God commanded them, they're like, don't take any of the gold here, this is just for the Levites, for them to do my work, kind of thing. And then when Achan or Achan steals it, and then he gives like a full confession afterwards when he was caught, and they're just like, All right, good.
Stone
Stone him to death. I was
and then
like,
burn him.
oh, that's a little brutal. Okay. But I guess you had to make an example out of him. He had his instructions.
Yeah.
And they had to do that to the whole family, to all the like the cattle, the sheep, the daughters, the sons. They did that to the whole family. So everybody got stoned. And that was kind of their way of weeding out a bad apple. They didn't want the family unit to remain because it might like decay and renew the sins that the father did.
Yeah,
It
that
is pretty
was the
severe though, eh? Like they cut down like the whole orchard because of a bad apple, essentially. They're like,
Yeah.
okay, yeah, you're all done. We don't even need your cows. This is gonna hurt us more than it hurts you, but that's the point.
Yeah.
That's something though that God or Yahweh has been very it's something common. Like very in the very first book in Genesis, all of mankind is basically stoned because of Adam's transgression. It's just something that God does. You mess up, every one of your generation after you is going to suffer. It's kind of messed up. This whole story of Joshua, really, I viewed it through the lens of they're just trying to show the power of their God through the Ark of the Covenant.
I think the Adam story can be translated or read a bit differently, because like the word that they use for Adam just literally means man. So it's just like man caused his own problems, so man's got to deal with those problems. It wasn't exactly that one single human that lived at the very start made this mistake, so we all gotta live with that mistake. It's like, no, we all make these mistakes all the time at the beginning. When it says in the beginning, it doesn't have to be the beginning of the universe. It could just be the beginning of each of our lives. So it's all just in the how you want to read it at the time, I guess.
I like where you're coming from, Scott, because and I think post Beyond Good and Evil, this is something that I'm noticing more and more, is that the more we define something, when we say it was specifically Adam that was there who made this mistake, it turns into this thing that is so literal and so pre-imagined that I don't even have any part in this sort of fantasizing of this origin story. And it's like, no, this is exactly what happened. And then you have people who are like, no, actually, that's exactly not what happened. There was 17 Adams, and Eve was sleeping around, and she went down into the city, and that's why God killed Adam. And Eve was actually more than a rib; it was something else entirely. And it's like, whoa, okay, settle down. Like, I think it's fair to say we don't have the answers, so let's stop pretending that putting all these parameters is going to help anyone.
Yeah, we make all these assumptions and then we lock those assumptions in place and then we can't go outside of those assumptions unless we
And it's
go against everything that's written in it. And yeah.
and just like so tangential, but same concept just over here. Like we do the same thing in our relationships when we have expectations of how someone will support us and how they will communicate with us. Because in our mind, we know how the world should be, and we know how good communication is, and we know how we like to support others. And then what happens is, because we've defined support and communication, when we do actually experience support and communication, we don't even recognize it because we've defined this thing so much, like, oh, I need you to do this set of words or this set of behaviors for me to feel that you're doing your job. And it's like, you can't do that. You've defined your relationship out of existence because you have so many expectations and imaginings that it will never compare, and you're better off just writing your own fantasy story.
Yeah, and imagine if there were no, if anybody in the world had no filter.
Oh,
Just
I think
imagine.
we've got a few.
You mean like 2-year-olds?
Yeah, probably.
Man, some of them never grew out of it, though.
You mean Trump and SJWs? We're not going there.
No.
Should I edit that bit out?
No.
Okay.
Okay. Let's talk about Jerusalem. How weird was it to read that, they just like, and it not even just Jerusalem, they did it with Gibeon. They got the wool pulled over their eyes
Well, it's
where
two different situations there. You can't lump those together.
watch
Jerusalem
me.
was a city that they weren't able to conquer just yet because they weren't strong enough, and they just had to justify it later by saying, "Oh, God allowed that." With the Gibeonites, they were fooled, and Yahweh just wanted Joshua to kill them all, but they were tricked into thinking that they were a faraway land and they were going to make peace with them. They didn't know they were Canaanites. Joshua made a pact with them without Yahweh knowing about it. And then afterwards, God was mad. He was like, "Why'd you make a deal with those guys I wanted you to kill? But now you got to live with your mistake because you're a man. You're an Adam. You're an Adam. You have to live with your mistakes. You made an agreement with them. You have to let them live in your city. The Hivites of Gibeon have a place in the promised land now because of what you did, Joshua."
Well, it's just wacky because, like, I can blame Moses and the pre-generation as well for the Jerusalem incident, right? Like, you literally left all your warriors in the wilderness for 40 years until they died, and then you strolled up with apparently 40,000 warriors. Like, when we were in Exodus, there was 2.5 million. And now I find out that there's 40,000 going into the land of Canaan, and they're like, "Oh, yeah, we couldn't conquer Jerusalem, so they just live with us." And it's like, oops. Like, really? I just
I think the actual conquering of Jerusalem happens later, and then like the tribes split up. I don't know. I haven't read it yet, to be honest.
Yeah, there's definitely, and there's more to this story, right? And it's like
Absolutely.
you can't develop an opinion, you can't point fingers, because there's literally 2,200 more pages to this story.
Yeah. And just to tangent off that, there's, plenty of stories outside of this story that we don't have access to. Like the fabled Book of Jasher that is mentioned throughout the Bible, but the first reference is in the Book of Joshua when he's talking about the part where the sun freezes in the sky, and there's a part where it's like, "Is it not written in the Book of Jasher that this would happen?" And I did some research on that, and basically we don't have the Book of Jasher, but they've published two versions of the Book of Jasher, which happened in like one was created in like the 12th to 15th century, and one was published in like the 1800s, something like that. And they're all just trying to say like, "This is what really happened. I translated this from the Hebrew manuscript itself," but then it's like got accused of being a fabrication, and I don't know for sure, but
That's really
and
weird.
it's I
Another
guess.
interesting thing happens at that same point, though, right? Like, when he freezes the sun in the sky, that's when they're Yeah.
going to defend Gibeon, which is this group of people that are Canaanites that are now being fought by another group of Canaanites because they've allied with the Israelites. And we have the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth. I'm butchering all these names, sue me. Lachish, and Eglon. And they come and they're like, "Sorry, you're partners with Israel. We have to completely destroy you now, even though, 20 minutes ago we were brothers. It's over now." And there's all this infighting, and it's like, so what are you gonna do?
Yeah.
It's a divine land grant, from Yahweh. So there's going to be people who are pissed off. Their land is given away at the edge of a sword. Can you imagine?
Yeah, the equivalent
Like,
would
if
be your landlord coming to you and saying, "Hey, your house belongs to that guy now." Like, "Oh, who told me? Like, is this the first this is the first I'm hearing of it."
Yeah, or like growing up in some sort of area with really low income apartment buildings, and some guy decides that he wants to build a highway right through your entire town. And so he hires a whole bunch of guys to sneak into your apartment and burn them to the ground to completely devalue the property so they can be demolished and then put in a superhighway.
Yeah.
Troy.
Ridiculous.
It's kind of like a, oh shit, what's it called? Hitchhiker's Guide to the
Yeah. That's great. Like, we just, from 1000 BCE
Galaxy.
to now, we have been doing and telling the same stories.
Yeah,
What the
man.
heck's going
Well, Will, you brought something up, and I don't want to just glaze over it, but you said the sun and moon stood still. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And I just think we should focus just for a second on, some of the completely bizarre things that happened in this book, like the River Jordan being parted, just like the Red Sea with Moses,
Yep.
the sun and moon staying still for 24 hours. I think that's about what they indicated.
Well, it was a whole day, it said. It said about a whole day. So I don't know if
And there's
that's.
like lots of hail as well, right?
Yeah, it's hard to say if that's day as like the normal time the sun would be out or day as a 24-hour cycle. So we don't really know what they're referring to there.
And some people have attributed that to like an eclipse, like an annular
Right.
eclipse that happened in 1200 BCE. But like, how can
But
you?
eclipses don't like hold the
Yeah.
sun or moon still.
It also said it's never happened before and it's never happened since. So eclipses happen
Yes.
all the time and they would have been familiar with eclipses.
Thank you, Scott, for bringing that up. Yeah, so Joshua asked God to still the sun and moon, and it says never since then has God ever listened to man again. So that was like the last thing God did for us, as far as like showing his might and force. Because this story is all about like the force of their God. They have this magical Ark of the Covenant, which they, I think I've read something where they like cut them their hand or cut an animal and squeeze blood onto this thing. So it's essentially like a blood sacrifice tool. And that's what appeases their God.
Right.
Like
That's wild. Weird. Then
there's
Jesus
a
came
few.
along. Then Jesus came along and retconned the whole thing. Said, no, God helps you all the time. What are you talking about? Well, okay.
Okay. If you say so, Jesus.
Move on to the next book.
So I think another important aspect of this book is the renewal of the covenant. Like they've had to do this a few times. There was what you said, Will, about 2 million people in the desert, and that dwindled down to about 40,000. And so I
Yeah,
think,
and they end up doing a recircumcision.
yeah.
right. So I mean, this covenant stuff, this is pretty heavy duty stuff. They're cutting a covenant where it's kind of like where you cut your hand, your neighbor cuts their hand, and then you shake on it. And that's like covenant, whatever covenant you have with that neighbor, that's how they do it. And so they do it the same way with God. They're killing or sacrificing an animal, or circumcising their foreskins, and that's their show of that they have skin in the game.
Yeah.
And they're making this covenant with like an external entity. And what I found significant in my own life is that, like, what if you make a covenant with yourself as a way of staying on your own path? Instead of making this covenant with a God, you make a covenant with yourself. I'm sure Christians would say that's blasphemous because then you're essentially equating yourself with a God. I don't know.
I wouldn't necessarily say that's the case because you're just essentially making an oath to yourself. Even if whatever God is out there you worship, you act as if that God is telling you to make that oath.
Right,
Or
so if you're
maybe.
making an oath to yourself, you have to treat yourself with some kind of respect. Otherwise, you'll lose the oath. You'll just
Yeah.
forget about it. So you got to have some kind of skin, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
It makes me think of, I don't know, discipline equals freedom and making agreements with yourself that are non-negotiable, and that sort of the freedom that comes with it, I think is what you're hitting on too. Blasphemy aside, you really should be making a covenant with yourself to be the greatest version of yourself if you're interested in maybe living a life of joy, and suffering, but like, you know, being able to get past the suffering because you've got, like, I don't know, a code, right? Like, and I think we've been trying to do this for thousands of years, and cultures and societies have tried their best to come up with a sort of system that anybody could adopt, but then also they realized not everybody would adopt it, and then it got exclusive. And it's like you see that with the chivalry and noble knights and that sort of thing. And nowadays we're seeing it on the internet in shelf help and all over the place with these sort of books like The Power of Now and things like that, where we're trying to act as if we're good enough to live and do things. I saw this one metaphor about how this person's new role models are all of the villains in children's shows, because they constantly, every episode, they get defeated by the heroes, but in the next episode, they're pursuing this villainous plan with the same enthusiasm and optimism as the previous episode. And it's like, if they stopped trying to be a villain, the whole show would fall apart. Like,
Yeah.
there's no plot without that.
I
Yeah,
like that a lot.
it's the whole good versus evil, bad good guys versus bad guys tropes. And that's the only thing, that's the only line being followed in most stories. But they never focus on the psychological tropes like joy and misery and rebellion and self-loathing, part of the human condition.
And I think like they don't focus on the fact that if it wasn't good or bad, it wouldn't even be. That
Yeah.
escapism doesn't lead to interesting stories. That, you know, hiding from the world for fear that you'll fail doesn't sell books.
Yeah, it's just like talking to a wall.
Is there a comic book, Scott, where nothing happens and it's interesting?
Well, I know one show.
What's that?
Well,
Seinfeld.
well, like, yeah, there's Seinfeld, Friends, pretty much any sitcom. They're all about nothing, but
But there's controversy and drama and intrigue and meandering.
there's always a battle of good versus evil. And sometimes, you know, the line between the two is skewed. Sometimes it's pretty clear. But it all depends on who's writing the comic, right? Like, the Bible has how many different authors? You could say the same thing about, you know, Spider-Man or Batman. Everyone has a different image of what God is. Like, let's just look at Batman for a quick example. Like, the earliest Batman comics are like the world's greatest detective or detective comics, whatever it is. We got like the hokey movie with Adam West. Wasn't until Frank Miller came along that he was known as the Dark Knight. Man, you gotta read the Frank Miller Batman comics, and then you gotta read like the original. Like, same with Spider-Man. Read like some of the original Spider-Man comics and then read like a Todd McFarlane. So much different. So you could say the same thing about how the Israelites were interacting with Joshua and how they were interacting with Moses. They were when under Joshua, they were under a God who seemingly told them to go to war and almost nothing else and like follow the laws. Under Moses, it was just like, you know, it was just about the laws and surviving in the wilderness and getting ready for the promised land, even though it's, you know, it's not for us. We got to get ready for our children to go to the promised land. And then under different authors, under different storytellers, the story's different. So when Joshua's writing the comic book, the arc changes a lot from when Moses is writing the comic book.
And it's interesting when you think about it too, because if you've got 2.5 million unruly people, like you could try and put the fear of God into them, or you could just say that they're not worthy and that it's just not going to happen, and then start over with the next generation. Because if you put the fear of God into a 0 to 7 year old, it'll stick. But if you put it into a 26-year-old or a 35-year-old or a 45-year-old or the 88-year-old who was still going to war in the time of Joshua, like it's not as convincing. But like if you just look at like DNA, genetics, subconscious influences, it makes good sense because it's a lot easier to brainwash and conform a society when you start at birth.
Yeah, and the promise of starting the next generation into a larger fulfillment is somewhat of a good promise to instill into the minds of the Israelites, knowing that their future kids can survive this and thrive in the promised land.
Yeah, when they renew the covenant with the younger generation, the second generation, there's a moment where they talk about gathering flint and doing the circumcision because this next generation had never been circumcised. I mean, at that point, I think I'd just be out. You're going to do what? I don't think so.
Well, at that point, too, like, no one was circumcised except for two people. The only other people that were circumcised under, like, the first round under Moses was Joshua and Caleb. Like, they were the only two that were circumcised already and had to do every single other person in the camp. So it must have taken a long time. And did anybody else have the translation in their book, The Hill of Foreskins?
No. Nope. Glad I didn't.
Yep.
Tell us about the Hill of Foreskins.
I'd rather not. That was the one thing I didn't look into anymore. I'm just like, okay, moving on.
right.
Okay.
So, did they not get infections from this procedure?
I can't imagine.
I would assume that the ones that did get infected, they were just like, oh, they were impure in the eyes of the Lord, so he struck him down with his infection. They weren't worthy to enter the promised land, so, you know, God took care of them.
I don't know. Like, these people knew that bats were bad, and they knew that fire was purifying, and if they're gathering flint, like, it doesn't take much to make a clean cut. You burn the blade, heat it up, and then they specifically say they gave them time to heal, and I mean, just an incy bit of wound care will go a very long way.
I'm worried about cross-contamination a bit too, like, oh, let's just give it a quick wash and go again. Don't worry, the water's holy. The water's holy, you're good.
Just line them up, boys. Running down this line of 40,000 men.
Oh. Like, you don't have a bit of rubbing alcohol for me or something?
And it's interesting you bring that up, because, like, alcohol is definitely a thing. Maybe by this point they know that it is helpful. Like, the city of Gibeon, I was reading about it when they were excavating it. They found wine stores that would have stored 95,000 liters of wine. Like, so these people knew about alcohol.
Yeah.
I have faith that hopefully, you know, if at least by the last 10,000 you figured out a good system of how to deal with it. Like, I don't know, it was probably really ugly.
Well, it's kind of funny with the Gibeonites, they God turned them into woodcutters, essentially water boys for the home team, you know.
Yeah,
I think it was in chapter 9. It's like, and you Gibeonites will always be the water boy for Israel.
Yeah, which really sucks, because when you look at, like, just doing a little bit of reading up, it seemed like Gibeon was a pretty happening city. I don't know which came first, the Israelites or the happening, but either way, it's upsetting to get the demotion.
There was a lot happening back in the day. Like, Synapsian mentioned, the city of Jericho was over 5,000, like 5,000 BC is like one of the oldest estimates. I like watched one biblical scholar and he was like, you know what? I believe the city of Jericho is as old as 8,000 BC. I'm like, you're just making up numbers at this point. But like, it's cities literally piled on top of cities, so. Like, when Jericho fell, they just burned it all down and then built more on top. So, you know, to tear down the walls with 7 trumpets, I think there was a little bit more to it. There's Isaac Asimov talks about how Joshua being such a military genius, it wouldn't have taken much just to take your guys marching around the city every day, silently, just as a distraction, while the other half of your tribe is undermining the walls, just digging underneath, so it would collapse on the seventh day when you could all blow the trumpets at once. I'm like, oh, the whole process was complete. We can just watch your city fall now. There's literally nothing supporting them. All we had to do was dig a hole sideways and your city fell down. You were focused on the guys walking around the city for 7 days.
Speaking of
Yeah,
which,
in
when are we
this case
gonna?
with the,
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, Synapsing.
I was just going to say, in this case with the falling of the wall of Jericho, did they break the whole covenant of not working on the Sabbath? Because, I mean, they were doing stuff every 7 days.
That's a good question. It
But I
doesn't
guess
really
they were
go into it.
instructed to by God.
I
They were
mean,
like, no, don't worry about it.
maybe the seventh day they didn't actually do anything. They just blew their trumpets and then the walls fall down. They didn't do any digging on that day. Or maybe they skipped a day. Who knows? Maybe it was in
And
the
I mean,
middle.
are we classifying warfare as work at that point? Like,
There's another question. Another question about the Sabbath that I've heard from some scholars is that the Sabbath doesn't refer to the seventh day of the week. It refers to, just the seventh day in a cycle. So the point of the Sabbath isn't not to work on Sunday or not to work on Saturday. It's to take a break every 7 days. Have a day of rest whenever it's fits in your schedule kind of thing makes a bit more sense than on Sundays no one's allowed to do anything. It's lazy day.
but didn't they kill a guy in Deuteronomy for doing just that? For like
Yeah.
carrying some sticks or something?
I don't have all the answers, man. Like I said,
But
the Bible contradicts itself. I'm just telling you what I've heard. And some people have said that. I don't know if they were like specifically looking at the Jewish scripture or the Greek scripture or what they were looking at, but that's the conclusion that someone that I watched on the internet came to.
Also,
Sorry, I cut you off, Pat.
I was going to ask you, Scott, when are we going to look into more of Isaac Asimov's take on the Bible? Are we going to include them here or just do it in separately?
Yeah, I've been reading. It's split into chapters, so every time I read a book of the Bible, I read his chapter on that book of the Bible. So, like
Has
it.
he done lectures like this before?
I'm not sure if he's done many lectures, but he's written a lot. He's done a few interviews that are pretty fun to watch, but I think like his written stuff is where he puts all of his material. Like just another example from his book is the word Gilgal literally just means circle of stones.
Oh.
So when yeah,
Oh. What?
whenever it says, oh, and they centered near Gilgal, is they're talking about the circle of stones that they made when they crossed the Jordan River and picked up the stones and made the they made Gilgal, and Gilgal is just a circle of stones. And he
They specifically said we're gonna put these 12 stones in a circle at Gilgal.
Yes.
And you're telling me Gilgal means
That's
12 stones?
the King James Version literally like has a bit of a mistranslation just in context. It's just like it really should say something more like it made the circle of Gilgal, the circle they gathered at the circle that is Gilgal. But it's just like literally just means circle of stones.
Who proofread the King James Version? Oh man.
Well, like there's that makes you want to flip
Semi-literates.
tables
Cheers.
hearing that.
Yeah.
Have we discussed what the significance of the 12 tribes is yet in the Bible Wave?
I mean, sort of. There's
Probably.
plenty of little significances that I'm sure we've touched on But what were you thinking of, Synapsing?
I was just like curious in general, why they chose 12 tribes. It's something like they already had 12 tribes in the area and then went back and redacted the book.
Well, they're
They
all
would
based on
justify.
the children of Jacob, right? Like there's Reuben, there's
Right.
Simeon, there's Joshua.
Right, but this was all written like a
Manasseh, not
thousand
Joshua,
years
Joseph.
after these alleged events happened. So it'd be pretty easy for them to go back and things up.
Yeah, when Asimov writes about that, he just straight up says that all of the names of Jacob's children are just eponyms for the tribes that came out of Israel. So I was just at one point, like there was a migration out of Ur of the Chaldees, which was like represented as Abraham. Maybe Abraham was like their patriarch, maybe he was the guy that led them. But when the Bible writes about Abraham leaving Ur, it's just like he went on his own solo journey with his immediate family. I'm not quite sure. But
But
yeah.
yeah, it's
To pick up on that point, I noticed that the writer of the book of Joshua kind of does a throwback to Abram because he puts like some kind of stone under an oak tree, and way back in Genesis before Abram, he like sat under an oak tree as part of his long. Anyway, I thought that was interesting.
So, like, just to recapitulate, Jacob's 12 sons in order of birth were Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. And then there was the exception of Joseph. He didn't become an ancestor of a tribe because his two
Yeah.
sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, were adopted by Jacob and they became the tribal eponyms. Eponyms? How do you pronounce that, Scott?
Eponym.
Eponyms that you were talking about.
Yeah.
But it's a chicken or the egg situation again, probably.
Yeah. Like what can we really say? Was there really a guy named Jacob, or was there, just a tribe that called themselves the Jacobites that wandered around and became the Israelites afterwards when they incorporated all of the other tribes? It all
Brief
gets
pause
messy.
to say goodbye to Synapsion. He's got to run away. Thanks for joining
Okay.
us.
Thank
I
you.
gotta go, guys.
See
Good discussion, guys. Check y'all next time.
ya.
All right.
God bless. May the force be with you.
Or equal to mass times acceleration.
Yeah, that too. All right, where were we?
The death of Joshua.
Right.
Synapsing leaves, and we just have to talk about death.
About where we got to, right? Like the
Yeah.
Book of Joshua, in summary, is the first campaign into the land of Canaan and then the division of said lands. And I think the biggest takeaway for me from Joshua is that while it's informative, it's not enough to base any opinions on. And so that I've been saying this the whole Bible journey is like, yeah, I'll be the first one to make an opinion about something, but I'll also be the first one to contradict myself. And maybe eventually I'll get to a place where I have a strong opinion that I'm comfortable like standing on and dying on that hill, but I don't see that happening for many thousands of pages.
It's going to take a while. I mean, we got a lot of books to read.
Yeah.
Well, what did you guys think of the one moment that Joshua had? It was like, I've seen it referenced as his burning bush moment, where he like sees a soldier on the other side of the river and he says, "Are you with us or against us?" And he was just like, "No, I am in the army of the Lord."
Yeah, Synapsion brought that up earlier, and it was one of those things that it just kind of popped up, and it's like, oh, okay, so God's got like what, an
Yeah.
archangel that he sent down to fight, and we're just skimming over that. Like we don't even go back to it throughout the whole book.
Yeah, or at all.
I look at that as like this weird, inconsistent blip where they're just like, oh yeah, no, there was angels. Throw that in there. Like, quick.
It's just like a tiny little artifact. I mean, we're talking about comic books before and how different writers pick up different, titles or whatever of books that are being written. And some people will always have to make references to the stuff that happens in like previous volumes. So all the comic book nerds will be like, ah, he read the actual original run. Good for him. He knows the superheroes. So like, it's just like there's a line in the when he's talking to him, and he just says the angel or whatever it is says, take off your feet or take off your shoes, your feet are on holy ground. And it's just like the exact same wording that the burning bush used against Moses. That's why it was called like the burning bush moment. So I was like,
I feel like I could spend an entire weekend going down that rabbit hole and trying to figure out what the heck that's all about. But like in my gut, it just feels like this sort of post-edit where you know where the story's going and you're making this sort of you it seems fabricated. It
yeah.
seems like a fabricated thing. It's too perfect. It doesn't actually tie into anything that's going on. And I think 1,000 years later, if you've got this book that's got all these references to these things and you put them in there, it makes it a lot easier to tell a story that has to do with that stuff, even though
Yeah.
it isn't really deep-seated.
Exactly the problem of like a lot of modern comic book runs because it's become their job to implant the Easter eggs. So like when you're going through scripture, the deeper you go in, it's just like how much of this is just coming out of the guy's mind? How much of this is real pure philosophy, just raw, and how much of it is I gotta write this bit in to please everyone so they get the connection.
Well, it's interesting that because you're talking through the lens of comic books, but like I grew up with video games, and I think World of Warcraft did it the best, where they had this entire world with quests and content and names, and they were able to just reference everything that has ever existed. I remember the first time I walked into the Undercity, and the bankers were like the Montagues and the Capulets, and I'd already read Romeo and Juliet, and I was like, ah, blah, blah, blah. I was all excited about it. And it's like it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't signify anything. But for someone who's read the thing that's being referenced, it inspires this sort of joyous moment where it's like I'm inside the loop. And now being in the position where it's like I want to make video games, what stuff should I reference? It's not even a question of am I going to make references to things or am I not? It's I'm a person who's lived an experience and I want to share that experience through reference to the things that got me to here. And if people get it and it resonates with them, then that's great. And if they don't, that's fine because the references aren't the point, but they're so intrinsic that it's this weird sort of sharing experience we do. And I don't fully grasp it.
You write what you know bit by bit, just like laying down bricks that right after somebody else has laid down a brick.
Yeah, it's crazy. We are all upon the backs of our ancestors reaching higher.
On the shoulders of giants, you could say.
Thought we killed them all?
Well, that's just the thing. We're on the shoulders of the giants that we've murdered. I mean, if you listen to the or if you read the
Put that on
Prosetta
a kindergarten poster.
if you read the Prosetta, Earth is literally made out of the corpse of a frost giant. So, I think there's a lot more to that saying than first comes to mind. Because
Yeah.
we talked about the Nephilim and how it could be translated as like the heroes of a forgotten age. And like we could say we're on the shoulders of giants, we're on the shoulders of heroes of a forgotten age, and we don't really know how we got here.
Yeah. So one of the things that I don't think we'll be able to get into, but that whole carrier pigeon communication, country being scared of God notion, it makes me wonder about the trade routes that were going on at the time, because that's probably the only way you can get information across a country is like vast trade networks. And I haven't heard much about an Egyptian Canaanite trade network, but like it had to have existed, right? Like, because that's how you communicate information.
There
I'm
were.
sure.
I'm sure there were just ordinary messengers traveling,
Yeah, for sure.
just like the spies were looking towards other land and seeing if they are conquered by another tribe or not. If it's safe to travel there, then they report back.
Right.
Yeah,
Yeah, I guess that's a whole notion too.
there's definitely lots of evidence of trade routes between like most of the lands in Canaan to like Mesopotamia and a little bit further east, but like it's hard to get into it 'cause this is like the collapse of the Bronze Age is happening at the same time, and this is when all the trade routes start to pretty much go under, when all the tribes are taken out by the sea peoples. No one agrees on where the sea peoples are from, but they came in and wiped everything out. And then the Israelites came in afterwards from the aftermath, and they're like, well, we'll settle our tribes here. So, like, when it presents Joshua as this great conqueror who conquered all these lands with the edge of his sword, he's really just cleaning up the mess, if you think about it. Because Canaan took the biggest brunt of the sea peoples because they just ran straight in there from the Mediterranean, and they weren't stopped until the Egyptians were able to, make them like corner them in Philistine, basically.
Be good to get information on that. I'd like to know more about these sea people you speak of.
Yeah, so would I. There's not a lot of information. Some say they come from Crete. Some people say they come from like Greece, or some people say they come from Italy or the islands further off of Italy. Like it's really like everyone disagrees. I've heard it all. Even aliens. Aliens.
Ancient aliens.
Yeah. Man, I'll be honest with you. I used to be right into to that ancient alien stuff. Right up until I watched a documentary called Ancient Aliens Debunked.
Simple
Sounds about
Enough.
right.
Yeah.
Well, before we digress into talks of alien conspiracy theories, is there any other major aspects of Joshua you feel we've overlooked and would like to dissect or analyze or speculate on?
We kind of went through Joshua's death. It's kind of a little bit. Do you want to go in a little bit further into that? Or just
Yeah,
leave it as it
sure.
is?
He was old.
He was
He was 110.
110 years old. And I actually saw one biblical like speech where this guy made a big deal about Joshua being the same age as Moses when he died. I'm like, no, that's not right. That's not true. And it was the same guy that said 8,000 BC for the fall of Jericho, or the start of Jericho, rather.
How old was Moses when he died?
120. So this guy said, like, not only was Moses 120, but Joshua was 120. Then he made a big deal about how the Bible overlaps and how similar they were. I'm like, maybe there's something to the symbology that they didn't die at the same age. Maybe Moses was worth 10 more years.
It's strange. It's very strange.
Yeah, there's also a
They
case to
all
be made.
probably died in their 60s.
Yeah, there's also a case to be made that ever since Genesis, all of the ages in the Bible go down gradually at different rates. Like ever since Methuselah being the oldest guy, no one's lived as long as him, and then it just goes 800, 700, 600,
Five, four, three, two,
120.
one.
Yeah, 120, 110. Oh yeah, now
40,
it's
48.
yeah.
Very young age.
My father makes the argument when he's talking about, or when the Bible's talking about the ages of like Noah and those such that were living for hundreds of years. He says, no, no, this is an interpretation issue. It's actually the family that generationally the name Noah lasted hundreds of years through his lineage. I was like, oh, yeah, that kind of makes a lot more sense than a man being 700 years old.
Yeah, it's just it's just an eponym for the tribe. They've made the same thing about the ancient kings of Sumer, like reigning for thousands of years. Like, oh, this king was on the throne for 5,000 years. Whereas just like, no, that actually, that dynasty, like the pharaohs in Egypt were using the exact same system. They just used a different word, or it ended up translating to a different word. So we understand them differently.
Well, it's like you just name your son, the heir to the throne, the exact same name as you. And like 200 years ago, you couldn't write a story about a town without people thinking it was always true and slanderous of the town. Like, imagine 3,000, 4,000 years ago, you've got someone named Bob ruling, and his son's Bob, and Bob's still ruling 50 years later. Nobody's paying attention. And then they're like, oh yeah, Bob ruled for 5,000 years. Like, no, he didn't. Anywho, we're tangential and rumini and
then Joshua says, you know, reminds them all, you're only allowed this one god, even the gods of your ancestors, get rid of them all, because, you know, we all know what happened to those guys, let's behave ourselves. And then he died.
I think that's pretty much going to go on for the next few books, I believe.
Yeah, there's a couple deaths in this one.
Yeah, I was going to say something like, when was it that we stopped admiring our conquerors? You know, because like, you think of Alexander the Great, you think of Julius Caesar, you think of Joshua, you're like, oh, these great warriors. Sun Tzu, you think of, like, Genghis Khan. Anybody, we're like, these guys were incredible, their impact on the world. But then you get to...
70 years ago.
Yeah, then you get to Napoleon. Oh, well, he's a little questionable. What about, oh, Big Adolf? You can't talk about him.
That's when it happened.
You can't talk about him. Yeah, but what was it that made us all wake up to the fact that trying to take over the world is actually evil rather than, you know, a just cause like it's portrayed in the Crusades? Newspapers? I think it's just liberal attitudes?
Yeah. 100p.
Maybe
that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Maybe that means that it's just people that don't experience war analyzing war.
Yeah.
And not understanding 100%. It.
Yeah, they don't get just how awful it is. And we don't. And I'm analyzing those that don't get it. And I probably don't get it. And I think Napoleon was respected up until like even 30 years ago, right? Like, but things have just been escalating so quick. And I mean, Adolf didn't help matters much, but like right now, what we're experiencing is this sort of rewriting of history and saying, no, we don't like how the peace is settled. We're going to pick them up and we're going to put them where we think they ought to have gone. And it's like what makes you judge, jury, and executioner of the past 100 years of history, but not the past 10,000? And why is it okay to start redrawing the lines based on just 2 centuries of domination or 4 centuries of domination? I don't know. It seems short-sighted and ignorant.
It's revisionism.
Yeah.
And also, to go on about conquering the world, it's, I guess some people would say that conquering the world is a bit of attractive. It's that power game.
Well, Nietzsche would say that.
Yeah. It's all about the attraction of conquering and winning.
And I think that there's still some conquering that needs doing. Like, clearly, the lines aren't where they ought to be. Like, if you look at Canada, I was watching Jim Gaffigan's new comedy show last night, and he's talking about how when they were making the map of Canada, it looks like someone fell asleep after they got to Quebec. Because the East Coast, it's like you've got provinces, and they're like this big. And then there's like Quebec, Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, British Columbia, and then the Northwest Territories. And it's like you didn't name
Like
it. You didn't even
straight
turn it into
line.
a. Yeah, but it's like that's enough for now. You could fit Germany into those 10 provinces and territories 100 times. You could fit Italy into Manitoba 16 times. And it's like clearly we didn't do the right thing there. And like obviously there's some pretty crazy crap that's been happening for the, thousands of years, but in the past couple hundred years, we've gotten to a place where, the flat earth sort of business concept has existed, where we can communicate with people in Thailand like that. And we are more aware than we have been in the past. Like we were saying a minute ago, 200 years ago, you could write a book and people would think it was the word of God. Nowadays, we're a bit more skeptic, and I think that there's a very fine line that needs to be walked because there is certainly a disparity of opportunity and equity and equality. And it should be on all of us to fix that. But the problem is when we choose one place to start, that one place feels like they're on trial and they say, but what about them? And it's like, no, they're all wrong and we need to do something better. But that's just so high up there that you can't deal with that in anger. Anger will not bring it down to earth. That much I can tell you for sure.
I guess it
It's
all
like,
depends on, I guess it all depends on the value.
I don't know if this is actually going to make it, so I'm going to say thanks for the podcast now. But I was having this conversation with my mother last week about this notion of, okay, so we stole the land from the native people and we need to give it back. And it's like, okay, but that's what we've been doing as a species for tens of thousands of years. It's kind of like saying to Germany, you need to create the promised land for the Jews because you guys were the last one to kill a bunch. And it's like, I mean, they do need a promised land,
I mean,
probably. And
how far do you go back to get the right lines for your map? I mean,
exactly.
Germany as a country is younger than Canada. Like, do you know the history of the Holy Roman Empire? There's like a million little city-states all packed into this one, like, collection that was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire.
Yeah, and we've got it's all over the world still, and that's the problem is we have autonomous regions, and there are people that feel like their history and their truth and their reality is better than everybody else's, and it's like we've all collectively made mistakes. Some of us have made a stark amount more than other people, but we're all gonna have to be compassionate if we want to get to a place where it's going to work for everyone, and it's going to require compromise, and it's going to require sacrifice, and it probably won't require cutting anyone's head off.
Well, I'm sure the Book of
I don't
Judges
know.
will tell us about that. Maybe. That, which is the next book we're going to read.
Yeah. I almost feel like from what we're saying here that, when we started to define war as something that was evil was around the same time we discovered or tried to define what was beyond good and evil, with modern enlightenment philosophy kind of ideas.
Well, it's, yeah, exactly. Like
Cro
philosophy,
cross-referenced with, scripture and mythology.
like if you look at sort of the life cycle of even psychology in the past 200 years, and then line that up with the colonization of Africa, you start to realize, like, oh crap, those two things are going in opposite directions. Like, we should have put the brakes on colonialization if we wanted to start looking at the mind and what it means to be good, because we screwed up Africa like 130 years ago. Like, oh my God.
Basically, just used it as a war field between the French, the English, the Germans, whoever wanted to fight over it.
Well, it's crazy when, like, you, the three of us could talk about France and their surrenders and their ability to, suck hard at war. But if Africa told us about France, it would be a completely different story. And it's a story that I wasn't told in school. And that's a problem, guys. That's a big problem.
I was watching a couple YouTube videos about this one, like, African king who idolized King Louis and idolized Napoleon. And he had, like, this huge ceremony and completely ruined this one African country's economy. Had this throne made for himself, had this huge ceremony that mirrored Napoleon's ceremony when he became king. Like, it's pretty crazy. Like, they take the French seriously.
Right.
Like, then you,
Yeah.
then, like, some, small town Ontario boy. What do you think of the French?
They're known for fries and quitting.
The French. You talking about the Putin? We beat them in the last war.
Yeah, and it's just like, I don't have the answers, but I certainly have the questions. And I don't even have all of those, but like, come on, guys, ask more questions. Stop telling me to figure it out when you haven't even looked past the frickin' 17th century.
Yeah, and I mean, how much time did we spend in school learning about the War of 1812 when the Canadians burned the White House down? Then the next day you learn, oh yeah, we weren't a country then yet. We were still a British colony.
Yeah, and the Native Americans actually saved us more so than we did, and then we took all their land because we thought it was pretty.
It's like the flash forward that begins in a story, and then once something tragic big happens, we have to stop, put the brakes on, and then go back several years prior to the events.
Yeah, thank goodness time travel isn't real, eh? Oh man, if we had that figured out right now, we would have so many paradoxes and splintered realities and people trying to reshape history. And it's like, stop. Like, the
We'd
history
be
doesn't
dead.
define us. Like, let's
We'd
move
all be
forward.
dead. We'd
Yeah.
all be dead.
Maybe
100%.
it's a defense mechanism that we can't understand the Bible properly. We can't read it through the proper lens. Our own defense mechanisms are keeping us from destroying ourselves, like Nietzsche destroyed himself.
I would go so far to argue that our filters are defense mechanisms of a type. And I think that that's not necessarily bad or good. I think it's probably beyond good and evil. I think it's just a fact.
I think that's two puns we made throughout this recording.
Hey, that's not bad. We could get those numbers up higher.
Yeah, we can.
Those are recce numbers.
Yeah, I could talk to you about a utopian world all afternoon, guys, and I'm sure it would piss off every ethnicity
And
and
I could talk about
identifying
Spider-Man
group.
and Batman all day long, so maybe it's time we wrap this one up. All right. Any closing statements, Pat?
Nope. Pretty much
Okay.
covered everything.
Yeah. And then some. Well, till next time, what's next? Judges?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're
Are we
doing.
doing two of them at a time, right?
Yeah, it's first
That
judges and second judges.
I think so.
All right. We'll do both of those in one video for next up in our Holy Bible Book Club. Don't forget to check out our website, www.bookwave.club. And may the force be with you.
Yeah, we're equal to mass times acceleration.